Hello and welcome to Technically Legal. This is podcast 15 for September 8th, 2009. I'm Dominic Rabier, and with me today are
Ben Snitkoff,
David Liu,
and David O'Brien.
We have a special guest returning with us today, David Liu, and you're a grad student, is that correct?
Yes, I'm in the third year of my PhD. Third of many.
Third of many, and you're over at
Washington University in St. Louis.
And you mentioned you worked in the tech industry. Which companies have you worked for?
Yeah, I've had 4 summer internships at IBM and 1 at Google.
Ah, very cool. And what did you do at IBM, if you can share that with our listeners?
I did a number of different things, but the overarching idea was for 3 of those summers, I was working on differing web applications for both internal and company use, and the 4th one, I was doing some interesting stuff with multitasking with voice interfaces.
Sounds very cool. And what's your interest in law?
I think the best way to describe it among lawyers is I have a layman's interest in not getting arrested.
It's always a very good interest. Well, we've got 3 great stories for you this week. Lori Drew's official acquittal, the Terry Childs case, he's the San Francisco administrator who was jailed, and finally, Comcast's market share is not going to be held at 30% or less because a court has overturned the FCC's rule to that extent. Let's dive right into our first story. Lori Drew's officially acquitted. Lori Drew is the Missouri mother who had participated in putting up a fake MySpace profile that one way or another somehow led a 13-year-old girl who was a neighbor to commit suicide in a tragic situation. But the judge, George Wu, has issued his final opinion and acquitted Lori Drew from cyberbullying. So, opening this up to our panel, do you guys think the judge reached the correct conclusion?
So the initial charge was that under the, what was it, the
computer
that she was accessing MySpace incorrectly, or not incorrectly, unauthorized, in unauthorized manner, and not so much that they were charging her with the death or murder. It was more along the lines of, violating the terms of service of MySpace's, that MySpace had set up, and basically by registering under the fake name that she was using.
All right, so this was one of those really cases with unfortunate facts. You had this Missouri woman who basically lived down the street. She created a fake MySpace account, and she posed as a boy who was, I guess, a boy in real life that this girl might have known. I think it was the name Josh Evans that she went by. And she sort of assumed his identity and, flirted back and forth with this girl. And then at the end of sort of this little relationship on MySpace, said, "The world would be a better place without you. I don't want to see you anymore," or something like that. And then the girl ended up committing suicide. And then the prosecutors approached the case in a really novel manner, and they wanted to charge the woman basically with cyberbullying under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And the act, as you mentioned, David Liu, basically says that you can be criminally liable for exceeding authorized access on a computer system. And their theory was is that because MySpace has a terms of service agreement, and because within that agreement it basically states by using MySpace's services, and there's some other portions where you might some other times where you might agree to the terms of services, like when you create an account, by under those terms of services, if you violate them in any way, and one of the provisions within the terms of service was that you warrant that all the information you're providing to the site is true, by violating that, you are effectively exceeding authorized access on a computer system, and therefore you could be criminally liable under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act.
But doesn't that mean that...
Go ahead. Josh Evans is a completely made-up name.
It's completely made-up.
It's not an actual boy.
I think the reading was still under the same, the plain language of the terms of service said you're warranting, which means that you're sort of legally verifying, or you're going to hold yourself legally accountable for providing accurate information to MySpace. And even by creating, if it's a fictitious person or a real person, I don't think it matters. Just because you're giving false information to the website, somehow there you've exceeded authorized access.
So the principal thing the judge sort of decided to acquit Ms. Drew based on is the fact that the statute is vaguely enough written that anyone who didn't necessarily have as non-charitable intent as Ms. Drew did could be subject to criminal charges if her conviction had stood. Because basically violating the terms of service say that I'm feeling sensitive about my weight and I list on MySpace that I'm 30 pounds lighter than I actually am, that would potentially incur me for criminal liability.
Right. One of the things the judge noted was that this was essentially criminalizing violations of state contract law. So the MySpace terms of service are governed by California law. So anytime, under the government's position, anytime you violated the contract under California law, you'd be committing a federal crime.
Right. And I think the key legal principle that is at issue here is, does this pass some sort of constitutional muster? And you have these two different phrases in here. You have what exactly is unauthorized access in the scope of the language within the Act, and then what does it mean to have knowledge or intent as required under the Act as well? And what the court seemed to focus on here was that it was just way too vague. There was too much ambiguity in the way that the statute had been written, and it let the door stay wide open for people to try actions like this, criminal actions like this. And I think that that's probably the underlying problem here is that there's not enough notice for people to know exactly what might be criminal under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and what might not be.
So in holding that this statute was vague, did the judge necessarily find it unconstitutional, or is the statute now stricken down, or is it the question mark hanging over it?
Well, I think it was unconstitutional for the most part as applied here, but that does not strike down the act by itself.
Right. Unlike certain other times where if it were found unconstitutional, it would strike down the entire law. Like in certain First Amendment cases, like flag burning statutes, even if it would be okay to burn a flag, to prohibit the burning of a flag sometimes, if the statute were unconstitutional, they'd strike the entire statute. Here, they're just saying that her prosecution wasn't constitutional. So it's this one alone. You can still use the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act to prosecute hacking. You just couldn't use it in this case to prosecute the violation of the terms of service.
Makes sense. Anything else?
You know, the other scary thing about how this act might be applied is it seems to give a lot of deference to types of agreements, terms of service agreements that we see on websites, and it almost seems to assume that they're effective agreements by themselves, and that's an area of law that has not really been well tested. And even in the judge's opinion, the judge seemed to mention at certain points that he was considering wholeheartedly that a browse wrap agreement or a terms of service hyperlink that you see at the bottom of a web page is by itself enforceable. And I that's a problem because it's not well tested in the law, and I don't think that we should be giving deference to private parties like that to figure out what should and should not be criminal actions, because that's exactly what would happen here if this statute could be applied like that.
Right. Well, one of the things that the judge seemed to rely on to at least some degree was that nowhere in the terms of service did it say when a violation of the terms of service would revoke your authorized access to MySpace. Did anyone else pick up on that argument?
No, I missed that one. You want to elaborate a little bit?
Yeah. So essentially, it wasn't clear because I guess the argument had two points. One, that just a violation of the terms of service. Well, under California law, a violation of the terms of service would absolve MySpace of having any contractual obligation to continue to provide service. But right. It didn't specifically say that you have that if you violate the terms of service, your authorized access will be revoked. So she wasn't on notice that lying would actually revoke her access. It would just breach the contract. So while MySpace wasn't under a contractual obligation to provide service, it also did not have to stop providing service.
That doesn't really surprise me, because you try to avoid, when you're drafting these types of agreements, you try to avoid absolute language like that, because then you could have a weird situation where third-party beneficiaries try to enforce agreements between two other parties.
Yes, although that's, I mean, it's really hard to get a third-party beneficiary out of a contract like this, where there's really no named third party, and it's not clear that any benefits are supposed to be accruing in a third party.
A quick sort of procedural question. So Lorieder is originally from Missouri, yet you mentioned that this was a California court that held down the decision. If the parties were the United States of America suing Lorieder, or charging Lorieder, not suing, why did the case take place in California?
The case that I was mentioning, this case did not take place in California.
I believe it took place in California because that's where Fox News Corp, owns MySpace, that's where their servers are based. But what involvement Drew is questionable.
Yeah, this is in the Central District of California.
Yeah, this took place in Cali. And I think it is because of Fox News, which owns MySpace, which puts them in California.
Yeah, there also could have been a choice of forum doctrine. Well, mm-hmm. Oh, no, never mind. This is criminal. Forget I said anything.
Yes.
My God.
So, anything else interesting about this case, or anything that you guys want to comment about?
Well, I'm fully confused why the judge let it go this far, and why we had to have a conviction come out before he had to come back and then reissue this as an acquittal with this decision. Why didn't this happen procedurally before this even went to the jury?
To some degree, this is an area that, you know, the judges will decide how they want to act on it, you know, one way or the other. You know, the judge may have hoped that it would result in a acquittal by the jury, or, you know, just assumed that the government wouldn't be able to fully prove their case, and was reluctant. Because the risk of the judge handing down a judgment as a matter of law earlier is that it could then, you know, be appealed, and he'd have put in all that work. There'd be an appeal, it'd be reversed, and everyone would have to come back to California, and then there'd have to be a trial. If he does the trial first, and then overturns the verdict, and it gets appealed by the higher court can always just say, it goes back, the judge was wrong, and we're going to reinstate the verdict. So, to some degree, it's a time-saving measure on the part of the judge.
Doesn't really help the parties, though, with all the time and money that they've spent trying to get to the bottom of this in terms of the criminal procedures.
I also imagine with this case in particular, there's a degree of pressure, you know, that goes beyond computer fraud just based on public opinion and the emotions running high in this case. I mean, regardless of whether that legally has standing, that I'm sure was playing some factor somewhere.
What? You're saying that this prosecution was partially motivated by the public opinion? No.
Think of the children, please.
was there any other portions of the criminal code that Lorieder could have been indicted under?
So I think there was some stalking and harassment, but I don't think the laws properly covered that. I don't think there was anything that she could have been indicted for that would have held more water than this, at least at the time. We were talking last week or the week before about how some of those laws have changed since then to include cyber stalking and cyber harassment, but at the time I don't think there was anything that she could have been charged with, at least federally, that was better than what they charged her with, or at least more solid.
This is a great case to read, though, if you're interested in how lawyers try to apply things in odd ways, and you know, from a legal standpoint, it's really interesting to see them try to apply the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, as wrong as it might be in the end of the day, to a terms of service violation on a website.
This be the first opinion that I've read in a while, it was interesting to see sort of the changes in the authorized access changing, you know, what probably amounts to, you know, normal access, or the distinction between normal access and how she was accessing the website and whether or not she was actually authorized. I found that a legally interesting argument.
What about it in particular?
What?
What about it in particular? Sorry.
I mean, just as you were saying that it's a novel way to make the claim, to me, reading the law, it seems like, you know, the law was written for one thing and is perhaps being used a little bit liberally to apply to this situation.
So what is unauthorized access in the end of the day, and how might this decision affect the way that we think of criminal unauthorized access to a computer system?
Well, based on the terms of service, it seems like the you are authorized only if you agree to the terms of service. And therefore, since she did violate the terms of service, she was therefore unauthorized. But there didn't seem to be much enforcement for that.
Well, in a hypothetical situation, forget about the MySpace portion of this. If somebody is trying to get access to some sort of computer system, at what point does access become unauthorized? Does that mean that there is always has to be some sort of form of either express or implied authorization for any type of access to a computer system? I mean, that's the fundamental problem with this statute, is that it just does not define that. So assume that you have some guy that's attempting to hack into a computer somewhere. At what point does what he's trying to do become unauthorized access?
Well, I would imagine when he has compromised the computer system with some regard, and he's logged in when he shouldn't have logged in somewhere, or he's basically gotten access that is unauthorized.
Yeah, but I mean, that just brings up the next question.
Yeah, I know.
What's access? SSH to a computer that I'm not allowed to, that I don't have authorization to SSH to, and is that unauthorized access right there?
Not until you get to a command prompt that you shouldn't have access to.
I mean, but is that clear from the law?
No.
Okay.
And, you know, where does the authorization portion really kick in? I mean, if somebody is, you know, trying to hack into some sort of web interface, like say it's a webmail program, at what point does the access that he has to the webpage itself or any of the outlying web servers, does that become unauthorized? And that's the exact problem that you're seeing here. If you're wondering why this is so difficult to understand, I think because here you have a contract in the form of a terms of service agreement on a website that sort of outlines your relationship with a web page, and then you have this other situation where someone's maybe trying to hack into a webmail account and trying to legally define what exactly constitutes the point at which access is authorized and at what point it turns to unauthorized access, I think is difficult.
All right. Is there anything else we want to talk about this case, or should we move on to the next case?
I'm for moving on.
Let's do it.
There's some interesting stuff in the opinion about what actually constitutes access, but I can't make much sense of it not reading it this quickly. So I say
right.
Move on.
We will move on. Our next story is the Terry Childs case, who's a San Francisco administrator, I believe, for the city. Is that correct? Yes, his city network, for the city network. He refused to give root passwords to city officials, and prosecutors decided that he was holding the network hostage, and they jailed him. And the judge recently said in a ruling that he won't lower the $5 million bail that Terry Childs has been held on since his arrest last year in July. So, Ben, you're probably most familiar with this story. Can you tell us some more details about what's going on here?
Yes. Essentially what happened was Terry Childs was an administrator for the City of San Francisco Wide Area Network, their internal communication network. There were a series of changes that his bosses wanted him to implement, which he thought were inappropriate and dangerous, and he changed some of the root passwords and refused to turn them over to his bosses. His bosses called in the police. he was eventually jailed and agreed to give the passwords to Gavin Newsom,
Gavin Newsom.
Newsom, the mayor of San Francisco only. And this was, you know, over a year ago now. And he's been in jail since then. Recently, several of the charges levied against him were dropped. And he still has right now, he's only charged with having violated a state computer access statute, which basically says that, you know, he unlawfully denied somebody access to a computer system. And he's still being held on, like you said, $5 million bail, which is five times the bail that the California code suggests for the most serious crimes.
And 10 times the bail of opening a vault with an explosion.
Wow. So why didn't he want to hand over the passwords to the city officials when they asked him to do so?
He thought that they were performing their jobs incompetently.
So he basically he
really, you know, was the only person responsible for this network, and that he had, you know, crafted large portions of it. And there was one article I was reading that was saying that he really viewed this as a work of art, and that he had actually either did or considered applying for copyright on it based on technical artistry of this network. And so he thought that this was, you know, a very precious resource and that he was the only one competent enough to actually take care of it.
Yeah, just to clarify a few things, since the network itself is functional, you would not be able to copyright the network, even if he did think it was a piece of art. But moving on.
So they didn't want to lower the bail, and they originally had four charges, I believe, against him, and they've thrown them all out except for one charge of disrupting computer services.
Right.
What happens now? I mean, he wanted to get the bail lowered, and it didn't happen, so is he eventually going to get a trial, or?
So two things can happen. Most states allow for, in some circumstances, somebody to appeal a bail ruling. So he may be able to appeal this to a higher court to get that bail reviewed. Alternatively, he could also, and this is a stretch, say that file a habeas corpus saying that, you know, his civil rights are being violated. He's being held illegally because of he's being held for under excess bail. Underneath the Constitution, which Eighth Amendment, which prohibits excess bail and fines. But what's more likely is he's going to have a trial at some point. He's going to be found guilty or not guilty in a sentence imposed, and at that point he'll, you know, appeal that or be released.
So why didn't the judge want to lower the bail? I mean, he's not as... Or I guess to... But, we'll get back to that in a second, but... So did he ever actually reveal the passwords?
Yes,
to
he
anyone?
Did. He handed them over to the mayor of San Francisco.
About a week after he was arrested?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Okay. So why did the judge not want to lower the bail for him? I mean, does he really view them that this system administrator is such a danger to society that he can't be on the streets?
Apparently. He also thinks that the judge and the district attorneys also feel that he's a flight risk. That he'd likely leave the state or the country if he's released on bail. And, I mean, that's a very hard thing to disprove. Some of the factors that go into it is if you have family overseas, if you have money overseas, and I don't know what those things are. And a side note here, I guess a rat hole. The assistant U.S. attorneys in the Bernie Madoff case tried to argue that he was a flight risk because Bernie Madoff had dual citizenship for America, the United States of America, and for Israel. The problem with that argument is that all people who are Jewish have dual citizenship of the United States and Israel, or at least can get dual citizenship. So that argument was summarily rejected. I don't know if... Terry Childs is Jewish or has dual citizenship, but those are the factors that would go into considering whether or not somebody's a flight risk.
So what do you have any thoughts on the statute that they're trying to try him under?
I think they were essentially trying to charge him under a, you know, this denial of service to the administrators. And I mean, normally when we think of denial of service, it applies to, you know, restricting users from being able to use the network effectively. But the, you know, from what I could tell, the network was working fine for this entire period up until, you know, a while after he gave up the passwords. It was just that they were being denied access to the administrator parts of the network.
Right, that's my impression too, that the network continued to function properly, but the judge's theory, or I guess the prosecutor's theory that the judge agreed with, is that the administrators were denied access because he retained sole power over those passwords and did not release them to his superiors. I mean, and this raises a secondary question, which is, under what circumstances can a network administrator, especially a network administrator of a large and... one would have to imagine a network that would have to be secure. Under what circumstances would they be compelled to reveal that information? Because there are people who, in the you know, who may be his superior, who should not have access to the administrator passwords. You know, there's no reason for the mayor to have that password. And if the mayor orders him to give him that password, should he have to give that up? It seems like it would be kind of dangerous for him to have to give that password to anyone who's above him in the chain of command.
From what I understand about the circumstances around his arrest, he was basically sort of met with some police officers and some people, and they met him in a room outside and basically were like, we want the passwords, and he didn't want to give the passwords for obvious reasons in that it was, he wasn't forewarned about this meeting. He didn't know that it was going to happen. They just kind of, I don't want to say jumped him, but it was unexpected, at least.
Right. I mean, I don't think any network administrator worth his stones would give a password to a bunch of people he's never seen before who accost him in a hallway.
Right, and say, we're the official people, we need the passwords. I mean, that's the perfect way to get the passwords.
Yeah, that's social engineering 101.
Precisely, yeah.
Or I guess maybe 103. It's,
sure.
Impersonating police officers is, you know, pretty advanced stuff.
But in addition, there was a history here of other people that he worked with, I think, asking him for the passwords or, you know, access to certain parts of the network, and him saying no. So I don't think it was completely unexpected, but I could understand in that situation not giving it up.
So I guess it was the tension between what he felt was in the best interest of the security of the network in terms of these people are simply not competent to maintain the passwords in a safe state, and what his superiors wanted. Do you want to talk a little bit about the statute, David O'Brien?
No, but this does seem to tie in a little bit to the case that we just discussed involving MySpace. And it, based on my quick reading of the statute, which is under California Penal Code 502C, and it's labeled the Comprehensive Computer Data Access and Fraud Act, it seems to be similarly worded to this. The Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, and based on my reading, it would seem that kind of like how the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act was being applied to the MySpace case, you have another weird problem here where the language of the statute doesn't really seem to meet up with the actions of the sysadmin. And so it looks like the judge has already decided that it's fine to go ahead with charging him under the statute based on not giving up a password, but denying service to other people, it would seem to apply to people trying to break into computers or trying to take down computer networks, like with a distributed denial of service attack or something like that. Not necessarily with withholding a password that you already had lawful custody of at one point. Did he, during the course, though, of his employment and when this dispute arose, was he fired? Did he resign? I'm sure he's no longer employed now at this point, considering he's being held, but what do you guys know about that?
I think he was in the process of being fired when they demanded the passwords from him. I think that was part of the... I'm not 100% on this.
Right. The situation before they demanded the passwords was that his direct manager had ordered him to route all network configuration changes through the city's change management system for approval, and he basically said that would leave everything exposed to attack. David Liu?
The article I'm looking at says that he was suspended for insubordination on July 9th, and then he was arrested, I think, the week after that.
And this was this last year? This wasn't just
2008, yes.
Yeah, okay, that's what I thought, last year.
Yeah, well, going back to the statute for a second, the portion under which he seems to be charged is subsection 5, which reads it'll be a crime if you knowingly and without permission disrupt or cause the disruption of computer services or deny or cause the denial of computer services to an authorized user of a computer, computer system, or computer network.
I haven't done the research, but I'm willing to bet that somewhere in the legislative history, what the intention was of that provision was to prevent things like distributed denial of service attacks, or not to prevent them, but to criminalize them.
That'd be interesting if it were the case. Also, be very hard to catch and prosecute people for.
I know.
That's another issue.
Is there an argument here that in withholding these passwords that he was actually just doing his job?
Well, that is exactly the argument I think that he has maintained since the beginning, that there's nobody competent enough to do this. This is within the scope of my job description, and you know, I'm the one that's been charged with maintaining this network, and you know, I don't think it's within anyone's best interest, including the city's, for me to release these passwords to anybody else. However, though, once he was no longer employed or at the point where he was either suspended and ordered to give them up by a superior, that's probably the point where he arguably would have had to disclose the information. And technically, he would have no longer been within legal custody of those passwords if he was no longer employed. But again, you've got like statutory language here that's written a little bit differently than the situation is actually how the situation has actually occurred. So you're trying to morph these facts into this broadly worded statute, and there's actually a couple different portions of this statute that you could try to get him under based on withholding those passwords. You could even say that, well, he had unauthorized access at that point where he was where he held the passwords and wasn't giving them to anybody else. And when he was no longer employed, he didn't have lawful custody of them, so that could constitute some sort of unauthorized access. Totally lacks permission.
Yeah, I like that argument. I think it's a bit of a stretch, but it's an interesting argument nonetheless.
Well, it's very similar to what you're saying with the MySpace case, too. That's why I think these cases are sort of similar, even though they, you know, are two separate statutes, involve different sets of facts. But you've got statutes that just have funky wording in them as it matches up to the facts of the case.
All right, any other comments on this case?
So at one point, they were charging him with having access to users' VPN information, so their login information for the virtual public network, that was actually included as part of the court records, therefore basically invalidating them because, you know, now all of these passwords are part of the public record. And I thought it was interesting because that was the actual time that the network stopped working, was when they had to change all of the passwords because they are now part of public record.
That's pretty classic. What you can do when you have to submit that type of information, actually, is you can seek to have the court keep it under seal, which means that it would actually be outside of what the public can see, but it would be on record that such information was submitted. I don't know if that's actually what happened in this case, but there are ways procedurally that you could limit public access to certain sensitive types of documents.
All right, let's move on to the next story. Our next story is Comcast went to court because the Federal Communications Commission had a rule that a cable television company can't have more than 30% of national market share. Comcast, which currently has 26% of the national market, went to court to see whether it could get this rule struck down, and it succeeded. It went to the U.S. Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia, and the court said that the rule imposed by the FCC fell under arbitrary and capricious and overruled the rule. So, first question, why is the FCC even bothering in terms of who gets how much market share for cable TV? I thought we lived in a free country with a free market. What's going on here?
Well, in 1992, Congress promulgated the Cable Television Consumer Protection and Competition Act. And what the act basically did was it charged the FCC with writing rules to ensure that no cable operator or group of cable operators could unfairly impede the flow of video programming. And so based under those rules in 1993, the FCC then came out and they devised this 30% rule, and they came up with all these different justifications for why a 30% market share cap was necessary. But again, they decided that based on this act, that the rule would further that goal.
So how could a cable operator using its extra 30% market share impede the flow of programming, I guess? Wouldn't they be able to provide more programming if they could reach more people and thus make more money?
The argument is that once they exceed some sort of market share threshold, they effectively become a monopoly in the area. And to be honest, that's totally the case, at least where we live here in Boston. I think we have Comcast, and then in some certain areas, Verizon's a separate cable provider, but it's very limited. I know that I can't get it here. I don't have any other choice but to use Comcast. And what it comes down to, though, is when you have one single cable provider, then all of your media programming and video programming that you're getting on your TV has to go through Comcast. So if Comcast decides that they don't want to include this new station that has just popped up or some new network or whatever, they don't have to, and they can totally suppress these new network content providers in certain locales if they want to.
I want to jump in here because there are two very distinct problems that we were talking about just then. There's first, so if you have one company that has a large national market share, like let's say there was some imaginary company, we'll call them Momcast, and they have 60% of the national market share for cable subscribers, then that problem, that monopoly problem, really comes into play because some new television station could come out and say, you know, we've got this content that we want to provide, and Momcast, being the largest cable subscriber, can say, we don't want to carry you, and suddenly they can't reach the majority of the market, and they can't make enough money to you know, continue providing their new service. The problem of individual monopolies. So, from a monopoly theory, cable providers are a natural monopoly. It's a lot cheaper to run one set of cables underneath the city than it is to run multiple sets of cables underneath the city. As such, you have these natural monopolies in a city, and there's really nothing we can do about it. People have even brought constitutional challenges to what are called franchise agreements with these cities that allow one company to be the provider of cable for an entire city or an entire county. And those are perfectly constitutional, and they're fine. And even from an economic standpoint, there's not a lot you can do about them. What the FCC is concerned about is when that monopoly goes from being a local monopoly to a national monopoly, or even a national, you know, duopoly or oligopoly.
You're right. So this is cable and video content. The video content distributors, it's such a unique network, basically, that the infrastructure is so different compared to other industries. It's so expensive to lay all that cable down. Some of it's been laid down for, you know, 50 or 60 years. You can date some of these guys back to laying the cable that was necessary to set up these infrastructures. And it's so expensive that it prohibits people from doing it today to become sort of these new cable startup companies, and it's very easy to get monopolies, I think, in this industry.
David Liu, anything you've thought interesting about this story?
I suppose my question is just, you know, so we do have these limits as to, or we did have these limits as to how much market share the cable companies can have, so why were they granted the exception?
That transitions beautifully into our next question. So if there's all these great rules or those great reasons for maintaining this 30% rule, how in the world did Comcast convince the court to say that the rule is arbitrary and capricious and have it overturned?
Well, there were a lot of problems with the way that the FCC had gone through its rationale in determining what this 30% rule actually was and why we should have it there. part of it went into how they are calculating market shares. And I can't pretend to have remembered all of this after my quick reading of the case, but at some point they were not including satellite providers, and so those were factored out of the overall market share calculation, and they had left out certain types of bundled services. I think in total, so there were these like four considerations that the court sort of focused on, and that included sort of the transition costs of moving in between service providers, a reluctance of consumers to switch based on bundled services. So the argument used to be that you might not want to switch between Comcast and Verizon because at one point Comcast offered voice services, they offered internet, and they offered cable, whereas Verizon might have just offered one or two of those things like voice and internet, or you know, TV and internet, but not voice or something like that. That's no longer really the case. And that was, you know, one of the turning points the court focused on. And also some of the other considerations that the FCC used that were that consumers were reluctant to switch in between the cable providers because they were they'd be unsure of what the programming quality was. And that's all I can think of. There's a fourth one. Ben, do you know the fourth one?
No, not off the top of my head.
But in any event, though, the 30% number had a lot of problems with it. And it just, from the way that the statute was worded, so we have to go back to the actual statute that enabled the FCC. This was supposed to be about not impeding other content providers from being able to access or from being able to get their content distributed through these cable providers. It wasn't so much looking out for the actual consumers. I mean, there are other laws that that supposedly protect us from the anti-competitive nature of the cable industry. This, the way that this is worded and the way that I'm reading it, this is not necessarily one of them. This is more about protecting the content providers themselves. And I think based on that, the 30% rule really didn't bear a whole lot of relation to what the statute was actually trying to do. And that was one of the underlying reasons that the court found it arbitrary and capricious. And by the way, if you're wondering about the language arbitrary and capricious, which sounds very random, that's actually the judicial standard for evaluating one of the FCC commissioner's decisions on a particular rule. And I'll quote from you here really quick. If the rule is either arbitrary and capricious, or it is an abuse of discretion, or not in accordance with other provisions of the law, then it can be invalidated by a court of law. So that's why we have that language written as it was.
So should we expect to see Comcast go up to 50, 60, 70% market share anytime soon, or are they still prevented from doing that?
Well, they certainly can go up in market share, but they might find themselves, if they facing an antitrust case from a different branch of government, the Department of Justice, or not a different branch of government, but a different governmental agency, the Department of Justice. But that would be more, not preventive, but sort of post, after the fact, basically trying to figure out whether they have a monopoly or whether they are acting competitively.
Furthermore, well, size alone is not a crime when it comes to antitrust. So just Comcast being a huge behemoth is not enough. They also have to do something that's anti-competitive and illegal, like forcing out other companies or price gouging to, you know, make it hard for other companies to join in to compete with them, things like that.
Exactly. So I think it would be very difficult to bring an antitrust action against Comcast or any of the other cable providers today, because as we've already noted, that the infrastructure of the industry is so unique, it sort of makes it difficult to have other competitors as is. And so it almost falls within the domain of what we call a natural monopoly. Mm-hmm. And as Ben just noted, size is not a problem by itself under the law. You have to have some sort of unlawful anti-competitive action combined with an excessive size of the company.
All right. Anything else on this story?
Well, not really, but you know, I think why this story frustrated so many people this week is because people really are frustrated about things like choice in terms of cable providers. Some people are worried about network neutrality, and they think that competition is good in this marketplace so that things continue to be innovative and continue to improve in terms of like access speeds and that sort of stuff and broadband penetration overall in the country. I think that the focal point was a little incorrect in the way that some stories covered it because of this 30% rule did not really seek to protect consumers so much as it did the content providers themselves. And so people immediately saw that, oh, this 30% market share cap is now gone. We're totally hosed. Why did anyone think to do this? These companies are kind of horrible with their tactics in terms of getting people on, and they're price gouging a little bit because it's so expensive to get broadband access, and people are thinking about throttling network speeds, and they're talking about deep packet inspection, all these awful things that ISPs might be able to do. But really, I don't think it was quite that bad, though, just on the way that this rule was constructed, and it seems that the court might have reached the proper conclusion based on the law as it's written today. Interestingly, this is also the second challenge to this law. There was a first challenge, I think, back in 1992, mm-hmm. which was based on the First Amendment.
Back in 2001, sorry.
Oh, was it 2001? Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, it was based on the First Amendment, basically, and they had sought to one of the cable providers. Was it Time Warner was the name of the case, I think?
I believe so.
Yeah, Time Warner had essentially sought to challenge the rule, claiming that this was a content-based restriction on speech, and that challenge ultimately failed, and the rule was, of course, upheld.
Actually, the rule was overturned, and that rule was replaced with a slightly different worded rule, which is what we have today, which was now overturned.
Okay, well, that's better yes. explanation than I can give. Thanks.
Okay. Anything else about this story? If not, then that ends our podcast for Podcast 15. Thank you all for listening. I'm Dominic Rabier.
I'm Ben Snitkoff.
I'm David Liu.
And I'm David O'Brien.
Have a great week. See you guys next week. Thanks again.